This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio and streaming Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start with a book. Ashley Thornburg and I are joined in studio by Keith O'Brien. He's the author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So there was a mural dedicated today in Moorhead, Minnesota to Florence Klingensmith. She is one of the five main characters in the book. And you will be speaking tonight at the Fargo Air Museum at 7 p.m. about these daring women. And you found out about this story on a plane.
Isn't it one of life's great ironies? Yes. I was on a plane in the spring of 2016. I was flying from Boston to Pittsburgh for a story I was doing for Politico magazine at the time. And for the book, I grabbed a book that had been sitting on my bedside stand. It was called The Astronaut Wives Club by Lily Koppel. And early in that book, as background to one of the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts, it referenced an all-female airplane race that had happened in the 1920s and it featured Amelia Earhart. And probably like a lot of people, I had never heard of an all-female airplane race in the 1920s. I'd never heard of Amelia racing anything. And I just started following it down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, welcome to women's history.
Exactly. Good point.
So why did you pick these five women? We know Amelia Earhart, and we know Florence Klingensmith.
Well, really, they picked me. You know, this is one specific narrative about women fighting for the right to fly and race planes in the time of the air races, which was really from 1928 to 1938. My story happens during that time window. And if you're going to write about women fighting for the right to fly and race planes in that little window of time, you really have to write about these women. They weren't just randomly selected. These women were essentially a group of friends, you know, who were all fighting for the same thing, all facing the same challenges. And it's hard for us to imagine today, but, you know, female aviators were so rare in the 1920s and 30s that these women would have had almost nothing in common with women they would have met in other walks of life. And so they really bonded to one another because they were truly the only ones who could understand each other.
Well, and they didn't even have that much in common outside of a passion for racing.
It's true. I mean, some came from money, some came from nothing. You know, some graduated from college, some like Florence Klingensmith didn't even finish high school in Moorhead, Minnesota. So they do come from these very disparate backgrounds, but they had this one thing in common, which was this love of flying. And the fact is, you know, in 1928, 29, most men believed that flying, much less air racing, was no place for a woman. You know, it's absurd, right? It's sexist, it's demeaning, it's obviously wrong. But at the time in which this story takes place, actual laws on our books forbid women from doing all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that men would publicly state and not even try to hide the fact that they didn't want women to fly, while shocking to us now, well, it was sadly not all that shocking at the time.
How did you research the stories? Because some of these stories have been told, but others less so.
So, you know, there's a great amount of secondary source material out there, and by that I mean newspaper coverage. You know, air racing today doesn't exist really anymore. But at the time, this was one of the most popular sports. It was covered like the NFL. You know, these were huge races with huge crowds and multiple newspapers covering a weekend's worth of events. And so there are quotes and dialogue and all kinds of stuff there. But what I really needed to bring them back to life as best I could in three dimensions on the page were records, archives, letters, diaries, journals. And that was the real challenge here. Obviously, my story takes place in the 20s and 30s. All these women have been gone for at least 40 years, some for much longer. And so, you know, it was a challenge to find some of this material. Now, Amelia Earhart, her archives are well known and they're voluminous. And anybody can go see them, by the way. They're at Purdue primarily and Harvard. And so, you know, I knew where to go to get Amelia Earhart stuff. But Florence Klingensmith, for example, was a much harder case. You know, she dies young. She has no heirs, no children, no descendants. Who would remember her? And I struggled mightily in the early months of my research to find material that would help me bring Florence back to life. And that was a real frustration for me because I knew how critical Florence was to the story. For me, the entire story turns on what happens with Florence. And it was only in one of my last-ditch phone calls, calling to the Historical Society in Clay County, Minnesota, that I stumbled onto essentially a treasure trove of material that the local historical society had been gathering for years.
It hurts me to hear you say something like, who would remember her when she blew the doors open and changed the name of this aviation game? You mentioned a little bit about how big these races were back in the day when they were popular, but just kind of set us up, how did they work? And then let's get into Florence and that door she blew wide open.
So for starters, we have to forget about what we know about today's air shows. Wasn't like that at all. These were real races with winners and losers, jackpots of money for the victors, enormous crowds. We're talking about like 500,000 paying fans in a single weekend.
Wow.
This is during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
So it's a huge sport. And there were essentially two kinds of races. There were the derbies, which would be long distance races over a transcontinental course, say, from Los Angeles to Cleveland or New York to Los Angeles. And then there were the pylon races, or as they were known, the free-for-alls. Pylons were 50-foot towers that would be placed in a triangular course around an airfield. And if you can imagine, the planes would take off, get into the air, and then start like a horse race start and whip around these pylons at a high rate of speed. And, you know, it was incredibly dangerous, both the transcontinental derbies and the pylon races, because they were pushing these planes to their maximum abilities. And these were still very primitive planes, oftentimes built out of wood and linen in order to make them light and fast. And, you know, so inevitably pilots crashed and inevitably they did die.
And inevitably Florence Klingensmith died.
Yes, she did. And, you know, you're right to point out how absurd it is to think that we don't remember her. You know, we all know the name Amelia Earhart. But the fact is, Amelia wasn't a great air racer. Florence was. And it was because of her specific skill at air racing, whipping her plane around those towers at a high rate of speed low to the ground, that she is invited to race against the men in the very first race of its kind, at the air races in Chicago in September 1933. This was a huge deal. And they made it a huge deal in the airfield that day. They introduced her to the crowd. They made it known that this was history. And Florence was right in that race that day. She was, you know, trailing the two leaders, but she was vying for third place. And in a race like this, trailing the two leaders means nothing because there could be problems. Planes can go down. Unfortunately, on the eighth turn at the home pylon, it was her plane that had a problem. This speedy plane, built again out of wood and linen, began to disintegrate in mid-flight. Chunks of the wing tore off and fluttered to the ground. And in this moment, Florence's plane went down and she died.
When this little plane, light plane, had been modified, it had a 220 horsepower engine that it was initially sold with, and it had been upgraded to a 670 horsepower engine and wood and linen.
It was ridiculously powerful, and it's worth noting this particular model of plane, it was called a GB, was the fastest plane of the era. It was also the most dangerous. You know, men crashed in it all the time. The famous Jimmy Doolittle once said, you know, flying a GB is like balancing an ice cream cone on the tip of your finger. It's impossible.
Yeah. And when men crashed the GB, the plane was at fault. When women crashed the GB, what they started asking if she was menstruating.
Correct. You know, this to me is one of the most shocking things in my book, one of the most shocking things and upsetting things in my research. You're right. You know, when men crashed, whether it was the GB or other planes in the air races, they were treated as heroes. And when Florence crashed that day in Chicago, despite the fact that thousands of people had seen the wing fail, despite the fact that in trying to save the plane and save the people on the ground, Florence did everything exactly as she should have done. When it crashed and she died, at the coroner's inquest the next day, the whole line of argument was that not that the plane had crashed due to mechanical reasons, not that the plane had failed due to the wing disintegrating. but the fact that Florence was on her period at the time. And I just want to stop there for a second because, you know, again, we think of that now as being so absurd. But at the time, this was a common argument that the actual the U.S. Department of Commerce, which was the regulating agency at the time, the FAA of the era, had actually written into the rules that women were not to fly within 3 days of their period. And so the men made this a whole focus of their review and investigation. And the male reporters ran with it. And, you know, the entire story out of it was that, you know, Florence had crashed because she was in a weakened condition and suffering from an illness that she had disregarded, you know, for fame and for money. And, you know, here was one of the most famous and accomplished female aviators of her time. And she wasn't even given the most basic, decent human respect.
Even by the coroners. They shipped her back naked and wrapped in newspaper. And the coroners back in Fargo said they'd never seen a body arrive like this. And they certainly would never send a body out like this.
That's correct. The local mortician in Moorhead said that in 50 years of doing business, he never saw another case like it before or after.
She was a heroine here, though. The Fargo businessman raised money to buy her first plane, the Miss Fargo, and then she was buried with a fair amount of attention and honor.
Absolutely. So she, you know, went at her funeral, which was held here in Fargo, was well attended, and she was buried across the river in Clay County. In her family cemetery there. Her grave is still there. It has been restored in recent years, and it is a very special place. And, you know, it is just a shame, and I think that's even understating it, that, you know, not only was she blamed for the crash, but then the men would use this as an excuse to ban all women from racing. And so this is why I knew from the very beginning that when I stumbled onto the name Florence Klingensmith, that she was so critical because, you know, she dies, of course, but in doing so, the other women also, you know, pay a price that they have to try to overcome.
I had heard about her before, but I had forgotten that she had done wing walking. She was a parachutist. She was a daredevil.
She was. And, you know, one of the coolest things I think about Florence is, you know, that she had to find her own path. You know, she did not come from money. Her family had no foothold in this new world of aviation. And so she couldn't, like some men and women, just go down and pay for lessons and learn how to fly. You know, in 1928 and 1929, she started doing the only thing she could do, which was enrolling in mechanic school. Now, she was one woman out of 400 men learning to work and work on and fix engines at what is now modern day Hector Field. And it was here that she begins to press her case that really where she needs to be is in the air.
Keith O'Brien is the author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. He'll be speaking this evening at 7 at the Fargo Air Museum. It's free and open to the public, and we'll have more with Keith in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home, creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Sometimes scrolling through social media makes us upset, and yet we can't turn away.
I would read something, I would feel outraged about it, I would feel compelled to share it with my friends. I would then be sort of obsessively checking to see whether people had responded, how they had responded, you know, lather, rinse, repeat.
How outrage hijacks our minds. This week on Hidden Brain.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and author Keith O'Brien. He wrote Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. This is part of the One Book, One Community effort. Keith, tell us about that.
Well, it's a huge thrill. The Fargo Public Library and other stakeholders here in Fargo and North Dakota chose it as the One Community, One Book Read. And there's been an entire month of programming that the amazing library here in Fargo has put together around aviation and around women's empowerment. And I'm just thrilled that this story is getting out there, and thrilled in particular that Florence, who has even been forgotten here in Fargo and in North Dakota, is once again being remembered.
Yeah. Are you finding the reaction? Are people fairly knowledgeable about this now, like at the mural dedication and at the book discussions?
Well, certainly people who have read the book are. And
yeah.
And I want to say, you know, specifically about the mural, you know, this morning in Moorhead, a mural was dedicated for Florence. And this happened not because of anything I did. It happened because a woman in Moorhead, Marissa Bankston Lorzel, just a resident there, read the book and was infuriated that she lived in Moorhead and had never heard of Florence. And it was this one woman, you know, pushing others in town to try to recognize Florence that really created a little bit of a movement there. And that, in combination with some momentum that was built out of the One Book, One Community choice, really helped bring this together and have this mural be dedicated this morning. And so, it's just a thrill that Florence is being remembered. And I know she would have just loved the event this morning.
Well, we've talked a bit about Florence and Amelia Earhart. How about these other three women, Ruth Nichols, Louise Thaden, Ruth Elder?
Each of them were so critical, you know, and like I said, they were all part of this crew of women who were the original licensed pilots in this country. They actually had a name for themselves. They were called the 99s because there were 99 of them. And, you know, each played an important role. You know, Ruth Elder is the first woman to try to fly over the ocean. It's not Amelia Earhart, it's Ruth. And she fails, which, of course, opens the door for Amelia. But it's actually another one of the characters, Ruth Nichols, who tries to get across the ocean next. And, you know, Ruth Nichols was sort of the opposite end of the spectrum of Florence. She was from money. She was the daughter of Wall Street wealth in Westchester County, New York. And, you know, she comes, you know, within a razor's edge of making it across the ocean in 1931, solo, all alone in the cockpit of a plane. And if she had made it, you know, everything we know about the history of women in aviation would be totally different. We may not know the name Amelia Earhart. We might know Ruth Nichols. And then there's finally Louise Thaden, who, like Florence, was one of the top air racers of the day and would ultimately have the last word, if you will, over the men in 1936.
Well, you kind of are giving a spoiler.
Well, I'm not going to give it all away.
Oh, come on. Yeah, well, Louise's story, I think, is especially fascinating, too, because she is a mother as well as being this amazing aviator. And I'm really curious, you know, we hear about powerful men, and then you hear things like behind every man is a woman, you know, propping him up or whatever. But let's talk about the role of a supportive husband.
Mm. I'm glad you asked that. You know, most people don't actually ask about that, but I'm glad you did. Yeah, so to have been a mother and an air racer in the 1920s and 30s was the smallest sorority of all. There were almost no wives, period, and almost no mothers. Louise was one of just a couple of exceptions. And she had two children, one in 1930 and the second in 1933. You know, and this is right in the thick of the air race time. And, you know, to imagine being Louise Thaden at the preschool PTO meeting is to imagine a woman who really had very little in common with those around her. But it's her husband, Herb, who I do think is notable. You know, many of these women didn't get married because they were intimidating to a man in the 1930s. They did not want to be married to an important, famous woman who garnered headlines while they did not. You know, that wasn't the case for Herb Thaden. He was happy to stand in Louise's shadow. And indeed, he would approve and push her to get back into the races even after their children were born. Again, today, you know, that seems like a very modern thing, something that we all can understand. A mother, of course, should go back to work and should follow her own passion, you know, regardless of her situation at home. But this was a very unusual situation in the 1930s.
Well, George Putnam and Amelia Earhart are an unusual couple, and he is supportive in kind of a different way. He wants to make a big deal out of her.
Correct. So Amelia also gets married, and she marries in 1931. And she marries a man whose last name anyway should be familiar to most, George Putnam, as you said.
Publisher.
Exactly. Putnam Publishing. It's still around today. You know, she essentially marries a powerful media magnate, you know, sort of a Rupert Murdoch of his era. And it was a source of jealousy among a lot of the other women who felt that, you know, because of her relationship, Amelia's relationship with George Putnam, she was able to stay in the spotlight and able to get her books published whenever she wanted, while they did not. And certainly there was something to that. You know, George Putnam spent his life, even after Amelia disappeared, keeping Amelia in the spotlight, in part because it was good for George. It was good for George to be known as the man who was married to Amelia. That's not to take anything away from Amelia Earhart's accomplishments, but the fact is she did have advantages in marketing, let's just say, yeah, that other women did not.
And I didn't realize until I looked at your book that she was a social worker before she became an aviatrix.
She was. She was a social worker in Boston. She was teaching new immigrants to this country how to speak English and how to get a job.
The women, you know, yeah, there's always going to be a little bit of jealousy. There's always going to be a little rivalry when it comes to any major sports or really any competition. But the women, you know, you sort of describe them as rivals in the air, but they really had to band together on the ground outside of a little, you know, jealousy here and there. So just talk about the role of how they had to prop each other up.
So they knew that they were all connected, that, you know, one of their failures would be cast upon them all. That was, of course, writ large with Florence. You know, if one of them failed, they would all be blamed. And they also knew that they had to stick together, you know, because of the entrenched discrimination that existed, not just in the aviation community, but in our culture at large. And so, you know, they really did bond together, and they really did fight for one another. And I found that one of the most ingratiating things about them is that they really did care for one another. And I found evidence of that in my research, you know. Ruth Nichols and Amelia Earhart will fight one another to get across the ocean first. You know, they both knew how important that was. They both wanted that history for themselves, and they kept secrets from one another about what their plans were. But, you know, they did also care for one another. And, you know, when Ruth Nichols has a terrible crash in 1935, it is Amelia Earhart who's one of the first to reach out and say to her, get well soon, essentially. We can't have you on the sidelines for long, you know. And here's, you know, one of her greatest rivals, you know, reaching out to her, Ruth Nichols, and wishing her the best. And it clearly meant a lot to Ruth because she saved some of those letters from Amelia for the rest of her life.
There's a man, briefly, who plays a central role here, too, and his name is Cliff Henderson. He put together these women's suffrage races, I think, as they were characterized.
Cliff Henderson was a bigger-than-life character, a P.T. Barnum-esque character, who was the promoter and the director of the air races. Among other things, not only did he bring air racing into a modern sphere, he chose the place where the 1928 air races were held. It was a bean and barley field just south of downtown Los Angeles. We, of course, know that bean and barley field today by three letters. It's LAX. but it's Cliff who has a very controversial role here because he invites the women in, but he ultimately banishes them as well when they run afoul of what he considers his rules.
Keith O'Brien is the author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. He'll be speaking this evening at 7 p.m. at the Fargo Air Museum. It's free and open to the public. Keith, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.